her mouth and get her
bang!
Out of line.
It's a clean fresh explosion of mint. Put a tic tac in your mouth and get her
bang!
Out of line.
It's a clean fresh explosion of mint.
Put a tic tac in your mouth and get her
bang!
Out of line.
It's a clean fresh explosion of mint.
Now in cinnamon too.
Today, in fact, every day, in grocery stores like this, right in your neighborhood, more people are putting more Skippy peanut butter in their market baskets than any other kind. Now, why is that? How come? Well, it isn't because the grocer forced them to do it. I swear he never twisted their arm and said, you buy Skippy or else. It isn't because Skippy advertises more than all of the brands put together, because we really don't. I'll tell you how simple it is. It's because you shoppers, like yourself now, are just plain smart. You're intelligent. And you recognize superiority when you see it. Now, you know that Skippy stays sweet and fresh and easy to spread right down to the bottom of the jar. And you also know that in Skippy, you never find a trace of oil separation or any stickiness or any dryness. But, of course, on top of that, you have the flavor of Skippy in mind. That wonderful flavor. It doesn't taste like peanut butter, you know. It tastes like big, plump, luscious, fresh roasted peanuts. Madam, I've noticed for a number of weeks now, you are one of our most loyal customers here for Skippy. Will you give an unsolicited testimonial for us, please?
Yes, I would. If you like peanuts, you'll like Skippy.
And now, let's get back to more talking television with Dave White on ChairVision Radio.
Talking television with Dave White. Certainly my favorite program, I can tell you that anyway. Folks, if you have comments on tonight's show, the program is pre-recorded. But if you have comments or whatever, email them to me, talk@ksav.org. All right, I am delighted to have from literally across the ocean and the seas a special guest on tonight. A gentleman who has a long resume and is going to be on tonight talking about his book entitled Patrick McGoohan, Danger Man or Prisoner. So a real pleasure to have Roger Langley. Roger, welcome to Talkin' Television.
Hi, Dave. Nice to talk to you.
Well, very much so. See, now, Wes, did you notice, there's a little bit of the pause, before the answers, and this way people know that it's really long distance. No.
Well, they have to know that it's, the planet to Dave, planet to Dave. Got to have a little connection there.
Well, something that way. That's right. I want the audience to know about how to get a hold of Roger's book, which I have not read in its entirety, but I am currently reading it.
But I have.
That's right. And Wes has, and it really is interesting. Patrick McGoohan is a very, very interesting individual in himself. Roger, you are personally acquainted with Patrick, so there's lots of firsthand stuff in here also, and it's a well-researched book. I want to tell the audience that they can go to my website, www.talkingtelevision.org. Go to the author's page, and I think there's about three of them now, and on page three, you'll see a photograph of the book, and you click on that as the site usually works. It'll take you right to Tomahawk Press, where you can order a copy, and I don't think you will be disappointed if you do so. Roger, how long have you been a Patrick McGoohan fan?
Well, I didn't really know I was a fan to start with. I used to just love Danger Man, which was later called Secret Agent on US TV, and when I was in my early teens, I would watch Danger Man on a Sunday night here in Britain, but years later it came back as a one-hour series and lasted for a few years and then went into The Prisoner. So I began to be a fan of those shows, but especially Patrick McGoohan, and at the same time he filmed Ice Station Zebra, which was a big blockbuster Cinerama movie. So the 60s were, there was a lot of Patrick McGoohan on TV and cinema. And it was when the Prisoner Society started, Six of One, in 1977, that I began, with many other people, collecting information about McGowan, which was very hard to find. And when it came to the 40th anniversary of the Prisoner, I found I'd accumulated so much material, it was a good idea to do a book, and this is the only biography of Patrick McGowan that's ever appeared. So I'm hoping that people who want to find out more about him will get all the information they need from the book.
Well, one of the aspects about him and why this is the only book, etc., is he was always a very, very private individual and very, what do you want to say, less than open on his personal life. Isn't that the case?
Yes, he protected his privacy and that of his family. And in fact, he will soon have been married to his wife for nearly 60 years. And they've kept out of the limelight. They don't go to the show business events, and they prefer to concentrate any publicity on Patrick's screen achievements and his acting, and that's always been the case. If you ask him about his family, if journalists or reporters ask him, they soon are told, don't ask me about that because it's private.
Yeah, and that's probably one of the, I think you're paraphrasing it from what I got of the book. He gave them that answer in somewhat different language.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, on occasion as well. I got a kick out of one of your quotes in there. As a matter of fact, you probably remember, they described it as a, I think it was someone came all the way from Los Angeles and obtained a brief interview, and as you said, the emphasis was on brief. I believe it was,
yes.
Mind your own business.
Yes. Yes, and another person was brave or bold enough to suggest that he should change his name because
It
wasn't a very star-sounding name, and he told him that that would be an insult to his father, and told him to get lost.
Yeah, I get a kick out of that. I kind of admired that kind of stuff because you get these half-baked know-it-alls, and they've got, you know, one of the best we ever had on this, Roger, we had Denny Miller come on the show. And here, how could you have a more of a film, you know, sounding, star-sounding name than Denny Miller, all-American star? And you know, they insisted he change his name from Denny Miller. It doesn't say, what in the hell am I going to change it to? That they finally ended up changing it briefly to Scott, but they kept the last name. They said, what am I going to be, Smith, Jones, or Miller? How can you be any more American than that? Well, anyway.
Well, it worked for John Wayne, though. I say it worked for John Wayne.
Well, that's right. It has worked. You know, there are places where it has been appropriate. But then they get carried away where just, you know, everybody has to have a different name. You know, a lot of people don't know what my real name was.
Of course, in The Prisoner, what was interesting, nobody had a name. And McGowan gave them all numbers.
Yeah.
So he said that society today, most people are treated like numbers.
I'm going to take this a little bit in sequence, Roger. I apologize for cutting you off on here, but since the early part of McGowan's career in Danger Man led into directly The Prisoner, we're going to start there and see.
Why don't we start even before that?
Well, I told Wes I was going to let him do the interview. He's probably sitting there wondering, well, when am I going to get to do the interview, Dave? Now, Wes, this is your chance here.
Okay, well, I would think it'd be great to talk a little bit about Patrick McGowan's pre-Danger Man career and what shaped him, because this was a guy that was really shaped by the English stage and always thought of himself as an actor and not a star. What could you tell us about his early career?
Yes, hi Wes, good to talk to you. When Patrick McGowan first of all lived in Ireland for his childhood, of course, even before that he'd been born in America, in the New York area, and eventually when his family moved to Britain, they lived in Sheffield, a city in the north of Britain, and he, when he was in his late teens, formed an interest in drama and joined several dramatic societies, and they were not professional ones, they were amateur ones, But when he one day went past the theatre in the Sheffield city centre, the Playhouse, he went in and asked for a job as a stagehand, and that was his first introduction to professional acting, because within 2 years he was their leading man on the stage. It was an incredible transformation from an assistant and stage manager to leading man. And guess what? His wife-to-be joined the company, and he courted her and married her in 1951, and they were on stage together, so it was quite a romantic beginning and a very solid grounding for him in the acting profession on the stage.
One of the things that really I didn't know about in your book was the influence of Orson Welles on him.
Yes, and when they eventually got to London's West End, he appeared in Orson Welles' production of Moby Dick on stage, and he also did his own almost one-man tour de force, which was the play Brand by Ibsen.
Yeah.
And he was so proclaimed by the critics at that time in the late 50s. He won an award, Best Actor, and he was in several television plays because of his prowess, and he always was a different style of character in every production, and he impressed many people. They wanted him for many TV plays and stage plays.
Would you say that Orson Welles helped shape the mode of thinking that he had when he finally did The Prisoner?
Yes, he saw Orson Welles, as you know, was a magician, and he was also McGowan's mentor, and he was so in control of the production that McGowan saw that one man could actually control everything from the scenery to the casting and the way the play is directed. And he was impressed by that and wanted to get some of the action like that for himself.
Well, okay, how about his time with Walt Disney? I don't know if any Americans remember, but Patrick McGowan was also the Scarecrow of Romney Marsh.
Yes, that was shown in three parts on US TV, but over here it became a cinema movie over here called Dr. Sin, based on a fictional character from the area of Kent on the southeast corner of Britain, where he would be a vicar by day in a church, and by night he would don a mask and be a masked raider and helping the local people who were mistreated by the local people in charge. And he did a film for Disney at that time also called The Three Lives of Thomasina, about a cat actually that had magical powers. And he also in the 80s did another film for Walt Disney called Baby, Secret of the Lost Legend, which was hunting for a dinosaur that was still alive out in the jungle somewhere.
He liked Disney and Disney's productions, did he not?
Yes, he thought they were solid family entertainment. And even in this century, he did voiceover for the animated Disney movie Treasure Planet. So he's done Disney work over a period of 40 years, and he thought they were well produced, the Disney films, and something you could take your kids to without being afraid of what they were going to see.
All right, we're going to take a quick time out here. We've got a couple of ads here for Armstrong Tile. Listen to these ads close, folks, because they're funny. One of the highlights of this Armstrong Tile is the asbestos that it contains. Do you think this dates the ad a little bit? And king-size Coca-Cola. And then we'll come back. Lots more to talk about. We'll talk about McGowan, his personal morals, and how that affected his television program. When we return to talk television on Sherevision Radio.
This is the action.
This is the room.
The active room.
This is the floor for the active rooms. A beautiful floor for an active room like a family room. It's the newest design in Armstrong embossed Exelon tile. Vinyl asbestos with the beauty and texture of a handcrafted swirl chip design.
a floor that belongs in the active room.
It's just one of many beautiful embossed Exelon tile floors by Armstrong.
Armstrong.
Armstrong vinyl floors.
For all the active rooms of your home.
Look for a flooring retailer with this perk-up sign in his window. He has the latest Exelon designs and the whole story on installing and caring for your new floor.
Summer days when things don't go just so.
There's one important fact that you should know.
King-size Coca-Cola gives you that refreshing new feeling.
Yes, Coke and the King has more for you.
The great big value. Best buy, too.
Because after you pour,
there's so much more.
King-size Coca-Cola gives you that refreshing new feeling. That feeling. Refreshing new feeling. Coca-Cola.
You are listening to Talking Television with Dave White on Retro Radio. KSAV. World Class Radio on the World Wide Web.
Listening audience, we're going to have to start doing the program with subtitles, Wes. We're still working on that here, on how to do that on the radio. Anyway, comments on tonight's program, folks, send them to talk@ksab.org. Okay, discussing Patrick McGoohan and with our guest, Roger Langley. So let's go back to Wes Britton.
Well, one of the things that's most interesting about Walt Disney and the types of roles that Patrick McGoohan shows is that he had a real strong moral code. For example, he's unique in that he turned down being both the Saint and James Bond.
Yeah, that's correct. And when he took the role of John Drake in Danger Man, he made it clear from the beginning that he would have no gratuitous violence, no shooting of guys if it wasn't necessary, and no romantic scenes where he would be up close and personal with the leading lady. And that was his insistence in the contract, that he would keep the Danger Man episodes clean, and they were at that time 30-minute episodes, or in a 30-minute slot, in black and white at the time. And that's what he did. He said he wanted kids to be able to watch the program, and the TV was a guest in people's home, and he honored that.
Well, since we didn't have sex and violence, what do you think made the Danger Man so special? What were its characteristics?
Well, it was dramatic. It was powerful right from the beginning. When he, the main character, John Drake, walks out of a federal building in Washington, D.C., and he works for NATO. He jumps into his open Aston Martin car, which is interesting. It's a car that James Bond later drove. And he drives off to the next assignment, and the action is very fast. It's in a different location in the world every week. Lots of different guest stars and actresses, beautiful women, glamour, and exotic locations. And the beginning of gadgets and gimmicks, which they put into many spy shows throughout the 60s. And he even had that great opening catchphrase, "My name is Drake, John Drake," which was perhaps borrowed by Bond in the later movies, because Dr. No followed about 3 years later.
The original scripts for Danger Man came out more along the lines of the James Bond, i.e. the romancing the women, the shoot-em-ups, and so on. Mm. And it was McGoohan personally that said, no, none of that. Isn't that the case?
Yes, it is. And the director-producer, Ralph Smart, was an Australian, and he had this idea for this big production, a new big-budget series. And the head of the TV company, Lou Grade, later Sir Lou Grade, he saw McGoohan in a TV play and wanted him for the lead part because he saw him as a very tall, 6'2", powerful actor with just the right character for this strong arm agent that would right wrongs around the world. But when McGowan read the scripts, the first few, he just threw them out and said, I'm not having these scenes in it, I want them cleaned up. Which was extraordinary, because he took a gamble. They might have just said, well, goodbye, and they could have chosen somebody else. So it's a measure of his effect and importance that they kept him on and did what he wanted.
Why do you think that, well, here you have the John Drake character, and you have it without the promiscuous sex, you have it without the, I'm going to say the violence, certainly the unnecessary violence, I mean the violence for just violence's sake, just so you can have it, and a very successful show. Why didn't others follow that pattern?
Because they didn't have McGowan. He trained through his childhood to become a Roman Catholic priest, and he was going to join the church, and it was only in his mid to late teens that he decided against it, and by really a fortunate, lucky accident, became an actor, as I said earlier, in the local theatre. But when he'd been on stage, I think, in the London productions, he saw professional actors and dramatic performances on stage and great stars, like we've already mentioned Orson Welles in Moby Dick, and he was able to command the attention in even a TV show like Danger Man and say, this is how I want it to be.
Well, I think you've used a key word here when you say he was able to command. The success that Danger Man and Secret Agent Man had was McGowan's skill and strength and power, whatever word you want, as the actor. And without singling anyone out, perhaps others down the road had to have scripts that were, what do you want to say, exhilarated or added on with these superfluous attractions of, you know, who I'm going to make out with and whatever, because they didn't have the star presence, the real power to carry that role. And it took someone special like a Patrick McGowan to do it.
Yes, it did. And probably that's why in many of the 60s spy shows, they introduced humor and had spoof action and ideas in stories that were humorous. And you had agents that were almost playing it for laughs. There was some of that, of course, in the James Bond movies. But with McGowan, it was straight down the line. He used lots of different disguises. He used different accents. He was almost a different character each time. But there was this solid central character that people could rely on, and they knew he'd get the job done, and he was exciting to watch.
Okay, well,
there was a great deal of publicity. He was the highest paid actor on television over here, and he was the subject of many, many TV magazine articles here and in the U.S.
Well, Trudon, as the highest paid actor, the tax people over there greatly appreciated him as well. Wes, you go ahead.
Well, let me refer back to a previous interview on this very show when a fellow writer named Robert Sellers said he believes that Danger Man was the first TV spy show proper. I'm not sure he's historically correct, but wasn't Danger Man really the first one that really had a wide following and a wide influence and an international reach?
Yes, it was shown in over 60 countries, even in the early days. The writers, I think, all had a great interest in the producing different scripts and new ideas, and of course, as it evolved and became hour-long episodes later in the 60s, the whole of the swinging 60s era and all the psychedelia that later followed into The Prisoner, it just took the show along with it. And so some of the later Danger Man stories were more surreal and would take place perhaps while he was unconscious and imagining a story, or there would be some strange village where agents were being held, and he would go there in a story called Colony 3.
I was going to ask you about that very episode.
Well, I think they were starting to move towards The Prisoner, but what's interesting is that Drake's own character that was scripted for him was starting to rebel against some of the assignments.
Yes.
And so you have the character rebelling, but the actor was also rebelling because he didn't want to do them anymore. He did 86 episodes, so he quit and his character seemed to suddenly be kidnapped into the next series, which was The Prisoner.
What do you think the differences were between the half-hour edition of Danger Man and the hour edition?
Well, in the hour ones, he was now a worldwide agent working for a secret British service department called M9, and he was almost like a mercenary. He could be sent anywhere into a delicate situation in a foreign country and do what was necessary, or bring somebody home who'd been abducted, or recover stolen data without upsetting the whole government of that particular country. And he would be under a false name, or he'd be smuggled in the back of a truck, or dropped from an aeroplane. So he was an all-action hero, really, the sort that, following in some ways James Bond style, but on a tighter rein. James Bond, of course, was free to act immorally and violently, which, of course, John Drake wasn't.
He was one of the first TV spies I can think of who, as you mentioned, questioned his government and the motives and what was going on in the covert world. And that was kind of unique at that point in the 60s, wasn't it?
Yes. And I think he was very strong-minded about the way the world was going. He was saying there's too much progress, it's going too fast, we're losing our humanity. And that was very much a message contained in The Prisoner. He said later on, there was this wonderful quote, that The Prisoner was an abstract expression of the world we are living in and a warning of what's going to happen to us if all the gadgetry and the gimmickry take over from the creative people. And of course, we've seen that happen with computers. They now control much of the creation of our artistic material. Often there's not a human involved. You just press lots of buttons and out comes some wonderful image.
We don't have that problem here at KSAV, because most of our computers don't work, Roger. So we're the exception to your rule. I'm sorry, you go ahead.
No, I think the computer age, like any other age, it's perfectly safe in the right hands. It's just when people, as McGowan was warning, the wrong people get hold of it, whether it's a weapon or computers or some spying system. He was quite big on the question of surveillance. That's when he thinks it goes wrong.
Well, that's right, and this again ties into his personal desire to protect his privacy and his family's privacy.
He must hate today's exposure that people have in all kinds of magazines and reality TV shows, where people are pouring out their private secrets for public entertainment.
Oh, yeah, and I'm sure he's a big supporter of the Patriot Act here in the United States, too, Wes. Oh, yeah, you betcha. Listen, we're going to take our time out here, but I wanted you to know, Wes, how much I really held myself back. When you asked Roger what was the difference between the half-hour and the one-hour version of the show, obviously I was going to say 30 minutes, but I held myself back, so I wanted you to know that. We're going to take a time out, and this happened just by happenstance. We've got two ads one here. The first one is a long one for Ford Motor Company and their great new cars, and I didn't realize it, but it's followed by a Greyhound commercial advocating that you take the bus. All purely coincidental. We'll be back, and we're going to talk about The Prisoner in the next segment. Talking Television here on Retro Radio.
If we could take you through the plant to show you what is new and let you see what's going on and watch the things we do. If you could see the cars and trucks we're working on for you, you'd say incredible. Ford, that's incredible.
If you knew how much money we're spending every day, factories and people to help us find the way.
If you could see tomorrow the way it looks to us today, you'd say incredible. For that's
you are enjoying the best television on radio. Talking Television with Dave White on ShareaVision Radio.
Talking Television on ShareaVision Radio. You know, I think it's nice to point out that a brilliant man like Patrick McGoohan figured out that the place to live is in California, certainly not over in the frozen north of the United Kingdom, huh?
Yeah, well, that was your gain and our loss.
Well,
because it was in the early 70s that he was first of all in New Mexico and then moved into California and has been there since the early 70s, so about half his acting career was over here and the other half with you guys.
I hope that I'm not in trouble for revealing that what state he lives in. Maybe I shouldn't have been so bold, Wes. I might start getting a phone call. All right, let's talk about the prisoner, and Wes, you pick things up here.
Well, okay. Well, that's kind of the big question that everybody's been talking about forever and ever and ever is number six John Drake and the influences that are there. I'll just toss the ball to you. What are the connections between Danger Man and the Prisoner, and what aren't?
Well, I think people will see in the Prisoner connections, and there'll be people who quite rightly want to say there are no connections. But I think the truth is somewhere between, because the makers of the program couldn't overtly use references from Danger Man or Secret Agent or John Drake. But they put in lots of in-jokes. They had an actor in a late episode whose name really was John Drake. And they had a character who was Drake's assistant called Potter, played by an actor called Christopher Benjamin, and he was in both series. And they had John Drake's picture on placards and in his identity folder. So, really, there was a lot of clues that this was the same guy, or you could say just a guy like him who quit his job and had secret information, such as a secret agent. But McGoohan always said, well, he could have been just a nuclear scientist or even a bank clerk, which was quite interesting because McGoohan was a bank clerk when he first started work as a young adult. So, really, there's no obvious similarity between the two, but there are some aspects which make you think, I wonder if that was John Drake who resigned and got kidnapped. So possibly that's why they gave him a number. And, of course, in your opening sequence in America, they had a song sung by Johnny Rivers, which we didn't have, saying they've given you a number and taken away your name. And that was actually before it really happened in The Prisoner.
And I always thought that... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I said that's how they introduced John Drake at the beginning of each episode in the US. But of course, by the time of The Prisoner, everybody did have a number. And McGoohan claimed that if you added up your numbers on your credit cards and telephone and all the other numbers in your life, you end up with hundreds of numbers. But I suppose computers are the same, aren't they? They operate on numbers.
That's why it was thought Colony 3 was such an obvious inspiration on The Prisoner, because that was really a very similar premise, wasn't it?
Well, the people who, the directors and the crew, the people who made it, all had different comments about it. McGoohan later on said it was an allegory. It was a description of life itself, where you could look into it and see simple scenes, but that they meant a lot more when you analysed them. And he said he would be posing questions in the series for people to ask about what life meant and what was good or bad about it. And he stirred into the plots politics and education and religion and abuse of power, which was quite astonishing, really, for a primetime TV show. In fact, so much so that the TV company had to put out a small leaflet explaining much of what the aspects of the program meant, because the symbolism was so odd. There was a dwarf butler, there was a penny farthing bicycle, there were big white balloons bouncing around, killing people. And so the audiences often didn't really understand and wanted an explanation.
Well, this is because the program was different, was unique, was revolutionary. In other words, it was not what the audience was used to. Isn't that correct?
Yes, indeed. Well, it's a truism to say that there had never been anything like it before, and some people say there's never been anything like it since.
That was McGowan's intention, though, was it not?
Yes. He wanted people to be really shouting at the screen and agreeing and disagreeing. And when he was later, at the end of the season, when they cut it short and they weren't going to make a second season, he said he had to go into hiding because people were still pursuing him in the street and demanding to know what it all meant. But he said that it was for people to get their own answers. And the last episode, Fallout, was so unusual that it was totally unlike the rest of the whole Prisoner series, the other 16 episodes. So it really took everybody by surprise.
And he had to run off to Switzerland to get away from everybody.
Yes, he said he would have been lynched. Probably not, but he certainly wasn't popular at the end of the 60s over here for just teasing everybody. And I thought the end, and so did many, many people I know in the Prisoner Society, all think that the last episode is a wonderful piece of pantomime or nonsense or indeed artistic television, the classic performance by him, and taking TV at that time as far as he could.
Was it a mistake for McGowan to try to do as much as he did do? In other words, explain to the audience that McGowan did everything as far as The Prisoner. He was everything, was he not?
Almost. George Mark Stone was the story editor, and he'd worked on Danger Man, and so had David Tomblin, who was the director and produced a lot of the Prisoner episodes. And they were very professional men that had been in the business, and they had set designers and other script writers who really put together a class act and made The Prisoner really quite stunning. But McGowan did direct several of the episodes, he wrote some of them, and he altered the script on pretty much all of them. He even hummed the theme tune, apparently, for the composer to put it into music. So that was the extent of his control.
It was, I believe in your book you mentioned, you know, the success of Danger Man and Secret Agent Man with Lou Grade, who was the money man, if you will, producing these shows, was
yes.
So great. Lou Grade loved McGowan, so when McGowan came to him with this idea for The Prisoner, he said, oh, that's great. Yeah, you go ahead. It's going to be successful because I trust you. And this was the most expensive production per episode that had ever been done. And when Lou Grade saw some of these things and saw the content of these programs, I think you mentioned in there he was about to choke on his cigar, wasn't he?
Yes, he didn't really see it as the action-adventure shows that he thought he had commissioned or ordered. And because of all the questions being asked in ITV, the TV company's regions, because they were different ones all around the country, their switchboards were being jammed with people calling, saying, what does this all mean? And it's not clear as to why it came to an end, because there was a plan to make a second season and to take the Prisoner, the central character, out into the world, and the people who were after him from this place called The Village, they would all follow him into the world, and perhaps it would go full circle and it would be like Danger Man again with all these different exotic locations, but we'll never know.
Where have you ever been to? How do you pronounce the name? Is that Port Marion?
Yes, we have our Prisoner conventions there every year, and we have recreations of all the reenactments of the scenes. There's a big lawn with white squares on it for a human chessboard, where people hold poles that have the chess piece shapes on the top of them. We have the giant white balloons. We have the little open-top vehicles, the automobiles called mini-mokes, which buzz around the village. And the episodes are shown on a screen, a big screen, and all the parades and processions and speeches from the buildings and the balconies, they all take place. It's A lot of people have actually come to our conventions and said that they thought that The Prisoner was being remade and we were refilming it because it looked so much like the real thing.
I think it's just fantastic that you're talking about a show that only had 17 episodes made, and here you are, what, 40-something years later, and people are still reenacting them. It's still a tourist attraction, if you will, where these were made. I mean, just the longevity of it and how it has held together. It was McGowan selected the site where this was filmed. Was that not true?
Yes, and here's another coincidence. In the first episode of Danger Man, the half-hour stories, they filmed that one in Port Marion. And then 10 years later, when he was making The Prisoner, he thought that it would be the ideal location because it's almost like a closed set. And all the different buildings, it's like a chocolate box of different styles of architecture and colours. And they were able to just film the show there without changing anything on the ground except putting up a few cute signs which just said things like, walk on the grass instead of don't walk on the grass, or things like that. And lots of slogans and captions around the village windows. And back in the main studios in just outside London, they had to produce giant mock-ups of the Port Marion set as backdrops, and they filmed on two large sound stages, even at the time when they were filming the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey, and shared some of the sets. And it was a big production and well respected. Lots of good guest stars, big British acting names at the time.
Okay, we've got a couple minutes here before our next break. Wes, you would get back in.
Well, why don't you talk about the various number twos, since you mentioned the guest actors. Originally, wasn't it the idea that there was going to be one number two, and then I think it was George Marxing who suggested, no, we should have a different number two every week, because that way we could demonstrate that there's no relationships that could be established, that there's mysterious forces at play.
Yes, it's a good point, Wes. We interviewed George Marxing a couple of times, and he said it's like when you go to your bank to complain and you've been speaking to a particular manager and you go back the next day or the day after to complain about something and it's somebody different and they don't know anything about it. And if you phone up, you get somebody else, and it's always this new boss always saying, well, I don't know anything about it. And so they thought it was one way of getting new guest stars on the show every week, but it also made the main character feel disorientated because he was never dealing with the same guy more than one week at a time. Although sometimes they did bring back a guest star to reappear in a later story.
Who was your favorite number two, Roger? Who for you personally?
Well, they were different styles. Peter Wingard, an actor who became famous in a TV series called Department S, and later Jason King. And he was a very smooth number two and very controlled, and in one episode does some karate. And then there was a much more senior type of number two, Eric Portman, who was also in many great British movies and wartime movies. And Liam Pern, who you might know over there, he played on RTV many years, a wily lawyer called Rumpole, and he was a great number two as well. But there were some quite strong women. A very long-term film actress, Mary Morris, was a strong number two character.
All right, I want the audience to know, I'm sorry, we're going to take our last time out. I want the audience to know that if you want to really get some in-depth discussions on the people that work, not just on The Prisoner, but with McGowan throughout his career, read Roger's book, because they're tremendous. The number of interviews have been done and the information is in there. There are lots of fun pictures in here, covers of different TV magazines, lots of photographs at Port Marion where The Prisoner was filmed. This is a terrific book, and anybody with an interest in McGowan or in these shows, you're going to learn plenty. You think you know a lot, you get this book, and you're really going to learn a lot from it. We're going to take a quick time out, come back, talk a little bit about McGowan as he appeared with Peter Falk in Columbo when we continue to talk television here on Share a Vision Radio.
Now for Blitz Beer, the man with a passion for the past, Gordon Polk.
Oh, hi. The telephone today is certainly a familiar part of modern living. But even back in 1907, when it was in its infancy, Blitz was already an established part of the scene.
Hello?
Hang on to the phone, Ethel. I've been made manager of the buggy whip department.
Oh, Harry, how marvelous.
Listen, why don't I pick up some Blitz beer on the way home?
We'll have a quiet little celebration, just the two of us.
Oh, how wonderful. And Blitz, too. I'll be ready by the time you get here. For goodness sakes, Harry, don't blame this on me. After all, you're the one who mentioned Blitz on the party line.
Yeah, it was kind of hard to keep a secret back in the days when 20 families shared the same party line. But even back in 1907, it was no secret that Blitz meant fun.
And today, that tradition guarantees you a light, lively, modern beer. A beer that tastes crisp and keen, yet travels smooth and satisfying all the way down. Remember, no other beer in the Northwest can top Blitz Beer's 103 years of brewing skill and experience. So in the future, bring on Blitz. The beer with the past.
My baloney has a first name. It's O-S-C-A-R. My baloney has a second name. It's M-A-Y-E-R. Oh, I love to eat it every day. If you ask me why I'm afraid. Cause Oscar Mayer has a way with C-R-O-D-N-A.
And the rest of the universe are listening to Talking Television with Dave White on Cherevision Radio.
Okay, and we are back for our last segment. Boy, time goes by in a hurry. You know, for those of you interested in learning more about the prisoner or discussing it or whatever, there is, what about the longest, what is it, Wes, the longest running fan club or TV fan club in the world, the Prisoner Appreciation Society?
Yeah, or 601. It started in 1977, didn't it, Roger?
Yes, I think Star Trek's been going a long time as well, because Star Trek began, the series began in the late 60s, and they didn't have so many breaks as the Prisoner had, because they had extra seasons and extra shows. So, and Doctor Who.
How can people become members of the Prisoner Appreciation Society?
Okay. Well, online you just go to www.sixofone.co.uk, and there is an online joining. You just click a button and you can join. You get glossy magazines. You can attend the events. And we have lots of members in the US and all around the world. In fact, we've been going for over 30 years, and we've enrolled over 50,000 members.
Holy folks, that's more people than listen to my show.
they're not all with us at the moment, but we've had many people join really around the world each time the Prisoner has been on the TV. But that's just, and the Society 601 is just based around the Prisoner. But the book, the biography of McGowan, covers his whole life, because he was 80 this year, and 60 of those years he's been doing TV and stage and film work. So it covers all of his films and all of his stage work.
All right, and I want the audience to know that if you didn't catch that website or whatever, just email me, talk@ksav.org. I'll be happy to send you the link, email it to you, so that you can find out and become a member. Sounds very, very interesting. One of the many achievements, the things that I remember about Patrick McGowan is... And to the studio, yes. Okay. Was his appearances in with his friend, his good friend Peter Falk, in the Columbo series. And he appeared in several. I remember, I think the first one was as the commander of the
Dawn's
Military
Early Light.
Academy. That's right, Dawn's Early Light, I think it was. But as usual, he was terrific in all of them. I believe he played villains in all of them, and he was just irreplaceable on those shows. So talk a bit about that.
Okay, well, the story goes that in the early 70s, he met Peter Falk on a plane. They were taking the same flight. And Peter Falk was starting to do the series of Columbo around that time because he'd already done two pilots from the late 60s and one later on. And by the third and fourth season, he was getting McGoohan involved, and it ended up with McGoohan appearing in or writing and directing six different episodes over a period of 25 years. And he won two Emmy Awards for the first episode, By Dawn's Early Light, and a later one, Agenda for Murder, which was great fun. They had lots of humour in that one. And him and Peter Falk were good friends. And Peter Falk has written the foreword for my book, at the beginning of my book. And he always praises McGoohan and says that he's such a complete actor and always gives his very best. And he says when he's really working hard and thinking, he said, I can even hear his mind humming. Well, whether you believe that, I don't know, but they certainly got on very well. And McGoohan didn't appear in two of the episodes, but he directed and wrote them. And he introduced some innovation into this episode called Last Salute to the Commodore, because he had the murderer revealed at the end, whereas in most episodes you see the murderer right at the beginning.
He also played a CIA agent.
He was a spy on one of them.
Yes, in the episode Identity Crisis, he plays Nelson Brenner, a secret agent. And he put in a few prisoner references, if you like, or just a tilt to the prisoner of wearing those boating shoes or loafers that he wore in the prisoner, and a jacket with the white piping round it. And he said, be seeing you, which is something he said in most of the prisoner episodes. And I think he just liked to have a bit of fun with the audience and said, you know, 10 years ago, do you remember that other one I was in, The Prisoner? Because he wrote many of these Columbos and directed them, he was able to put a bit of fun in.
Well, I remember that him as the CIA agent, he was a real villain because he killed Leslie Nielsen.
Yes. I enjoyed Agenda for Murder. He played a lawyer, Oscar Finch, and he was caught by going to the murderer's house and biting a piece of cheese that was on the table at the house, and he left the indentation of his teeth, which enabled Columbo to match it to his chewing gum that he'd just thrown in the bin.
Yes, that was fun. And, you know, Columbo, or the character of Columbo, referenced that show in a future program, as long as we're talking about a little trivia. When Columbo goes to college, he references matching or catching a killer due to a bite mark on a piece of cheese. So lots of fun to watch this. And I'll tell you, I enjoy watching Columbos because I like them anyway, but especially the ones with McGoohan. And again, it's his ability to just be so commanding, just so talented, that holds that together. I wanted to ask you, Roger, and Wes, we can get your opinion as well. Was or is, I shouldn't use past tense, is Patrick McGoohan an artistic genius?
Yes.
Well, I certainly think so. And I'll ask Wes for his opinion as well.
Yeah, go ahead, Wes.
In one word, yes, absolutely. And I think you would point to The Prisoner as being something that is so creative, so distinct, and especially in the case where one mind really shaped everything, some of it pre-planned, some of it he kind of put together at the last minute, that, as Roger said earlier, wasn't done before. It hasn't been really duplicated since. But I think his career extends much broader than that. But if you look at The Prisoner for a legacy, I don't know how you top it, really.
No, and you're correct in that a true artistic genius develops his own style, his own ideas. He doesn't copy. As we know, historically, many artists, maybe one could say the majority of artists, their genius was not discovered or appreciated in many instances until long after they were deceased.
Well, one distinction would be, too, is the focus on art. For many actors and celebrities that are out there, their personalities, and they go on and they do these different roles, and sometimes very well and sometimes very blandly. This is a guy that has been devoted to craft from day one. And that comes through, I think.
Yes. Well, in the couple of the episodes of Columbo, Ashes to Ashes, his daughter Catherine appeared in that story, and in the last one, Murder with Too Many Notes, his other daughter Anne appeared. In fact, he has got a third daughter, and of course he and his wife have now got grandchildren as well, and they have a large extended family, and they, now that McGoohan's not on screen so much, they live their private lives, and they have got so much to look back on, and people can thank them for so many different productions that Patrick's been enabled to appear in, because he said his wife, who was an actress, gave up her career so that he could pursue his.
We had, there's nothing phony about Patrick McGoohan. When you go back and, as we've mentioned, his strict moral beliefs, his refusal to kiss women, other actresses, just on screen per se. This wasn't, for many people, this would have just been phony publicity. This would be something to get a write-up and get your name in the fan magazine and generate some publicity. He lived his life, not just his career, he lived his life along those lines. Isn't that correct?
Yes, yes it is, and even in the later series, when he was in a series called Rafferty and he played a hospital doctor for 13 episodes, 1977 to 78, and he had lots of moral stories in that series, and he even put in prisoner references. He had a dog called Rover, which was the name given to those big white balloons, and he just wanted to say, look, the good guys are always there. I'm a good guy in all my shows, and if everybody was a good guy, the world would be a better place.
All right, and I think that's an appropriate way. We are out of time, and it has been a fun time. Roger, thank you so much for coming on and discussing this. I'll tell you, I'll thank you for taking the time to write this terrific book, because I'm really enjoying it, and I hope a lot of people will also.
Yes, it was a pleasure, and I have to say, of course, be seeing you.
Of course. Okay. If I was going to be like Columbo, I'd say, oh, and just one more thing. We're out of time here. West Britton, thanks a lot for arranging this and for coming on and being a part of it and really contributing so very much. It's always a fun having you on. And stay on the line.
I appreciate it very much.
For the rest of you, next week it's going to be variety shows. Toast of the Town, Ed Sullivan, etc. Everybody said, who? Who's he?
Right.
Another one back. I hope you'll be with us. America's co-host and I will be back with guest Jeff Broderick when we talk television one more time here on Sherevision Radio.
Odds are you won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man. They're giving you a number and taking away your name. One day, and laying in the Bombay, and the next day.